You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 278, Exodus 15, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. Busy as usual. I've had now almost 2 weeks of working at home.
Yeah.
How's that going?
Yeah.
It's actually been really productive. Yeah. I'm happy with it.
That's awesome. Yeah. I can tell since we have all of these Exodus chapters are into multiple parts, part one and two, and we're going to split 15 in part one and two. So you're really getting in there. We would have part one and two for the whole. Yeah, we're going to have to reel you in.
Yeah, well, we're saying that now, but the next time it'll probably be like four chapters grouped together, and then we'll have to apologize for that. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, I like it. I mean, I get to essentially, you know, just drill down on stuff that I need to get done, you know, for lots of things. You know, we have lots of plates spinning, but, you know, I actually get to do that and stuff that I just need to fill the tank. So it's real nice.
And we keep adding more stuff to what you and I want to do, which is, you know, we've talked a lot about stuff. So we keep adding it and hashing out. So maybe one of these years it'll actually.
People will hear at the conference, you know, we'll have something new.
Yeah.
You know, I think we can promise that much for sure. We'll have something new that we'll announce at the conference. So, you know, once the conference website goes up, you want to register for the conference, that's where you're going to find out. You're not going to find out before.
There you go. There you go.
You want to know, show up.
There you go. Absolutely. All right. Well, good deal. Well, yeah. Chapter 15, what are we going to be talking about today?
Yeah, Exodus 15, this is the Song of Moses. It's so called, you know, by scholars. Why do they call it that? Well, because it's a poem, right? Substantially, almost in its entirety, it's a piece of poetry in Hebrew. So this is one of those unusual sections in the Torah that isn't narrative prose. It's a poem. So that's why people call it that. And we are going to split this into two parts. So we're going to essentially hit the first 21 verses in this part, because the second part, when we get to the end, I think even if you sort of glance at the end, you're going to know why we sort of reserve that for a second part. But typically people look at this chapter, it's like, oh, it's just like a reiteration of the crossing of the Red or the Reed Sea, the Yam Suf. And sure, I mean, you can read through chapter 15 and that's kind of what it is, but that's just the surface. There are actually a lot of things in here that for this audience, especially people who've read Unseen Realm, and in some cases, the lighter version, you know, Supernatural, that book. But especially if you've read the book Unseen Realm, you're going to see that there are things in this chapter that sort of take you into Divine Counsel worldview content. And so, as is our custom here, you know, we're not going to do a verse-by-verse thing. I'm just going to go through the chapter and sort of drill down in places where there's just something like that that surfaces, and then we'll talk about it, why it's important, what it means, all that sort of thing. So let's just jump into the first three verses here to get started. Exodus 15 says, "Then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, 'I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name.'" In those three verses, Lord, there again, is the divine name, the tetragrammaton, Yahweh. One sort of peripheral note here, ESV has the horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The wording there in the Hebrew can refer to somebody who drives a chariot, so there, it's not inconsistent with what's gone before. It's just you might get that impression just reading through quickly that, wow, they were all riding horses. No, it refers to chariotry. But where I want to sort of do the initial camp out is the third verse there. Yahweh is a man of war. Yahweh is his name. Now, Durham, in his Exodus commentary, I'm going to read you a little section of his comments, and then a little bit from Carpenter. And then I want to take this verse into a larger issue that is really concerning the two powers in heaven issue. And you might have already sort of sensed that Yahweh is a man of war, just the language there. So Durham says, okay, there follows a description of Yahweh as victorious deliverer. He is Ish Milchama, a man of battle, a warrior, an undoubtedly authentic epithet the translators of the Septuagint found too embarrassing to keep. Now, the Septuagint, okay, actually alters this. And you might think, well, that's kind of weird. The Septuagint has, again, this is from Durham, I'll put it into English, Yahweh crushes wars, or basically, you know, wins battles or something like that. Instead of a man of war, it turns that into this descriptive phrase. And you might ask, well, why would they do that? Again, this takes us into, I'm going to speak as a critic now, you know, somebody who does Israelite religion and sees an evolutionary arc. You know, we've been in this territory before in Exodus, and you all know my position, you know, on this basically is I think that the evolutionary approach to Israelite religion is largely based on circular reasoning because it has so many inconsistencies, and we're going to get into that here again. Now, just as a jumping off point, there would be those who say, well, the Septuagint translator, you know, obviously, you know, this Hellenistic Jewish guy was offended by anthropomorphic language about Yahweh, transforming Yahweh into a man. He didn't like that wording because by the time of the exile, Yahweh was transcendent above the gods. And this is primitive religious thinking to cast the deity as a man and blah, 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 blah. And if you're thinking, well, good grief. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the Dead Sea Scrolls and Second Temple Jewish literature that have Yahweh as a man. You'd be correct. Again, so that ruins the evolutionary arc, the neatness of the picture. I think the most you could say is, I mean, there's nothing unclear about the Hebrew. The most you could say is the guy who was doing Exodus, you know, just thought this made better sense because elsewhere in Exodus, the burning bush. You know, Yahweh is in the form of an angel there, okay? Other places where Yahweh in the Torah is going to show up. You know, the people who did the translation of the Septuagint, who did the Torah, it's not just one person, okay? But you're going to have many that have no problem at all with anthropomorphic language, and then you got this guy that maybe you could say that about him. Maybe he has some other motive. We actually don't know. But people will assume, scholars will assume that they know the motive. They know why the translator did what he did because they are operating mentally with this evolutionary trajectory in mind that to cast Yahweh as a man is primitive. This is primitive religion. And it's more enlightened. It's more, what's mind expanding or something like that, more sophisticated, more intellectual, to abstract Yahweh as this non-person, this non-human, you know, deity entity that's just, you know, so transcendent out of the human world in every respect. This is the kind of language that you get when you read academic material about just religion in general, but here it's applied to the Hebrew Bible. And again, if you're sitting there, and again, if you've had good exposure to Second Temple literature, and even the late literature of the Hebrew Bible, you're thinking, well, good grief, there are lots of exceptions to that. Yeah, there are. That's the point. That's the point. There is no neat trajectory. If you were at the Naked Bible Conference last year, I did my presentation on how the Septuagint handles and also the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, how it handles the language of divine plurality. Because one of the axiomatic things in biblical studies is, well, when we get to the Greek period, the Hellenistic period, you know, they don't use sons of God anymore. They just take all these phrases that are primitive polytheism, and they use the word angel. Yeah, except where they don't. Okay, except for the 180 times in the Dead Sea Scrolls where they have B'nai Elim, B'nai Elohim, B'nai Ha-Elohim in divine council scenes, the stuff that's supposedly pre-exilic and now has been outlawed religiously. That happens to show up 180 times in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Septuagint does not consistently render these phrases with angelos, angel. I actually went through in that session. Again, I guess this is a commercial for the next Naked Bible podcast. This is the kind of thing we do. You know, we present, you know, good topics, research, and that sort of thing, because we know whoever signs up for that, you know, they care about content. But I gave a handout last year and said, look, you know, of all the places where you have divine plurality in the Hebrew Bible, plural Elohim, B'nai Elohim, B'nai Ha-Elohim, all this stuff, I showed, you know, how the Septuagint handles that. And there were only, as I recall, three or four instances where you couldn't find a Septuagint rendering that was literal, sons of God. In other words, there were only three or four instances where all the manuscript material we have says angels. It doesn't take it literally. Most of the time, they're just fine taking these phrases and translating them literally. They're not bothered by it at all. You know, but all, you know, scholars, again, have this template that they impose on the text, you know, this evolutionary arc thing. And it's just so inconsistent, but yet it is axiomatic. This is why I wound up doing my dissertation on this topic. And again, to my advisor's credit, he let me do it, but it was a fight every step of the way because this was contrary to the consensus opinion. And, you know, once he figured out that, yeah, Mike knows it's contrary, but good grief, there are lots of exceptions here. Then it was okay. And in other words, it was a good experience for me to see how a seasoned scholar, you know, sort of is embracing an idea but never actually looked at it, because it wasn't, you know, that wasn't really his field. So this is what you have, and you know Durham's comment here is representative, or not representative, but he at least points out that we have one instance here where Yahweh is a man of war gets sort of erased by translation. Now, Carpenter says, the new era, just the wording there, the new era of Yahweh's name and his great acts of judgment and deliverance is ushered in. Now, if you restrict that comment to the Exodus, that's a good thing to say. Carpenter's not one of these that's on the evolutionary trajectory thing, but again, somebody who is could read that, yes, the new era of enlightened monotheism here. You know, again, that's not where Carpenter's going here. Yahweh is holy, high above all the gods. This assertion, Yahweh is a man of battle, caused much puzzlement to the ancient translators. Maybe this phrase did, but again, the concept itself, you know, didn't, even though that's what's accepted. But Carpenter does add, the concept itself causes consternation among God's people even today. And I don't know, I look at that and I think, well, that's a little overstated, but it's probably still kind of fair, because again, there is something of a struggle. I'll use the word struggle, where because we have Jesus in the incarnation in the New Testament, I've met a lot of Christians that are surprised at their Old Testament, that you actually have God as a man in the Old Testament. Like they'd never seen it before. They never really thought about it. So that, I think if you're looking at it that way, then what Carpenter says here, that can be legit. Again, a lot of it is because people just don't look. They're not thinking in these terms when they read certain Old Testament passages. It sort of just gets glossed right over. Or we take things like the word of the Lord and think that that's just a voice in the prophet's head. You know, sometimes it is, but sometimes it is clearly not. Again, this is the two power stuff that I discuss in Unseen Realm. There's just no blanket statement that you can make here. There are plenty of people who aren't defended by it today, and there are plenty of people who weren't defended by it in the intertestamental period and on into the New Testament. Now, Siegel, Alan Siegel, he's the guy who wrote, you know, back in 1977, the Two Powers in Heaven book. Siegel, again, was a rabbinic scholar, was a Jew. He passed away recently in the last few years, and he wrote this book on the Two Powers of Heaven, trying to find the history of when did this teaching that there were two power, good powers, not good versus evil. This isn't like Zoroastrian stuff here, but two good guys, okay? Two gods, essentially, in Judaism, because he knew that Judaism used to teach that, because he's familiar with Second Temple Jewish monotheism or Jewish binitarianism in the Second Temple intertestamental period. So Siegel asked a very logical question. Well, if there were lots of Jews writing about this and they're fine with it, it was a big item of discussion, nobody was calling each other heretics over it, why did they start doing that? Why did they start making it off limits? Why did they start forbidding the discussion? When did that happen and why? You know, when did Jewish theology change? And in his book on the two powers, Siegel, again, makes a number of observations. Obviously, the whole book's about the subject, but specifically about this verse, he actually includes some rabbinic commentary on this verse. And Siegel's point is that, look, you can tell by this commentary that they are writing after the two powers idea has become forbidden. They know it exists. They know it exists dead as well. They know that there were people in their community that used to think this way, and apparently not too long ago by the way this is written. But it's very clear from certain selections in rabbinic material that we don't want to think this way anymore. And I'm going to read you this section because what this section actually shows is that rabbis started to write and talk like modalists. If you're not familiar with modalism, it's the idea that God could show up in more than one form. And modalism doesn't work with Trinitarianism because of things like the incarnation. Modalism to a Christian, again, because of Trinitarianism and the incarnation, all the deity of Christ, all this stuff, modalism is not acceptable language for Trinity. But here you have Jewish rabbis that sound like modalists. And the reason they do this, they want to start talking about God appearing in more than one form, is that, well, there aren't really two powers in heaven. It's just that God shows up in two different disguises, as it were. God shows up in two different kinds of manifestations. So that the two don't exist simultaneously. It's just God in different forms, periodically. And Siegel is on to them. He's on to the people in his own community, because again, this is what his book is about. So I'm going to read you this. So he's reading, Siegel quotes from the Melkitah of Rabbi Ishmael Bachodesh, 5 Shir Tefor. And here's what the rabbis are saying. I am Yahweh your God. You know, why is this said? Because when he was revealed at the sea, he appeared to them as a mighty hero making war, as it is said. Yahweh is a man of war. He appeared at Sinai like an old man, full of mercy, as it is said, and they saw the God of Israel. He's quoting Exodus 24:10 there. Now let me stop. If you go back and look at Exodus 24, it doesn't describe Yahweh as an old man. The rabbis are just reading that into that passage because they're thinking like modalists, okay? Back to Siegel's quote of the rabbi. The rabbi says, and at the time after they had been redeemed, what does it say? Like the very heaven for clearness, Exodus 24:10. Again, it says in another passage, I beheld till thrones were set down. Now he's quoting Daniel 7, verse 9. And it also says a fiery stream issued and came forth from him. Scripture would not give an opportunity to the nations of the world to say there are two powers, but declares, I am Yahweh your God. Exodus 20, verse 2. I was in Egypt. I was at the sea. I was in the past. I will be in the future to come. I am in this world. I am in the world to come. Now that's the end of the rabbinic section. So Siegel, again, is looking at this. And again, he's on to this trajectory. He knows what they're trying to do. He can tell that they don't want to land in two powers territory as their predecessors in the Second Temple period did so often. Because to the rabbis, you have to realize, folks, the rabbinic material is not contemporaneous with the Old Testament. When you start listening to people about what the rabbis say, that's medieval. That's when the rabbinic material is put together. Some of it, you know, some strands of it, some content strands, you know, go back into the Second Temple period and are relevant, you know, for like New Testament thinking. But this is not contemporary with the Hebrew Bible. And a lot of it is even contemporary with the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Second Temple period. It's after, it's later. And again, Siegel knows this because he's a professor of rabbinic literature, and he knows that they're trying to avoid landing in two powers land. So he writes this. This is Siegel now on pages 35 and 36. The exegesis notes the repetition of the name of Yahweh in Exodus 15:3. Let me just read it to you again. Exodus 15:3. Yahweh is a man of war. Yahweh is his name. So that's Exodus 15:3. So Siegel says, the exegesis notes the repetition of the name in Exodus 15:3 and explains its significance. Yahweh is a man of war is to be interpreted as a descriptive statement referring to God's manifestation as a young warrior when he destroyed the Egyptians at the Red Sea. Yahweh is his name, the other half of verse 3, is necessary because at Sinai he will reveal himself as an old man, showing mercy. Hence, it is important for the Israelites to realize that the same God is speaking in both cases, though the manifestations look different. The proof text for these statements is Daniel 7:9 and following, which describes a heavenly enthronement scene involving two divine manifestations, the Son of Man and the Ancient of Days. In this context, the reference from Daniel must be taken to demonstrate that God may be manifested either as a young man, that would be the Son of Man, or as an old man, the Ancient of Days. Now, let me stop there. You see what the rabbis are doing. They're looking for a way to handle Daniel 7. Son of Man, Ancient of Days. Oh, those aren't two figures. Those are just two modes of Yahweh. Those are two manifestations of Yahweh. And one goes back to Exodus 15:3. That's the young one, the man of war. Son of Man somehow is equated with the man of war. And then the Ancient of Days somehow is equated with Exodus 24:10. They saw the God of Israel. Of course, Exodus 24:10 never describes what he looks like. But the rabbis don't care. They need the two modes there. One deity, two modes, two manifestations, not two powers. God forbid we have two powers in heaven. Back to Siegel. He writes this, when the whole biblical passage is seen, the passage seems to describe more a danger than a solution. Not only does the passage allow the interpretation that God changes aspect, it may easily be describing two separate divine figures. More than one throne is revealed, that's Daniel 7, and Scripture describes two divine figures to fill them. One sits, the other seems to be invested with power, possibly enthroned. The Ancient of Days may be responsible for judgment, but delegates the operation to a Son of Man, who accomplishes judgment by means of a fiery stream. That this Son of Man is young or that his dominion is to be merciful, ostensibly the point of the reference, is hardly evident in the text. Now that's an honest comment from a rabbinic scholar about what the rabbis are saying. Basically, he's saying, these guys are just blowing smoke here. Again, because his book, Siegel's book, is about the history of this idea within the Jewish community. And why did it transition from being okay to being a heresy? Okay. So I just wanted you to know that Exodus 15:3 is part of the two powers in heaven debate within Judaism. And if you get into a conversation with a Jewish friend, they might have been schooled by rabbis, or they might go to their rabbi and say, you're not going to believe what this Christian told me. And the rabbi could say, just tell them it's two modes, it's two manifestations. Here, read Rabbi Melchizedek. That's what you're going to get. But Siegel, again, is honest enough to say, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Again, and in Siegel's book, what he's trying to do is show the reader how this was dealt with. But again, there you have it. He goes, the passage, if you actually look at the passage, they could just as well be teaching two separate individuals, not two modes. So let's move on to verses 8 through 12 here. Another thing I want to just land on a little bit briefly. In chapters 4 through 7 is, again, just a repetition of what happens at the Red Sea. We hit verses 8 through 12. When the Egyptians are drowned, we hit verse 8. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The floods stood up in a heap. The deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue. I will overtake. I will divide the spoil. My desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword. My hand shall destroy them. You blew with your wind. The sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? You stretched out your right hand and the earth swallowed them. Now that's verses 8 through 12, and I want to comment on all those verses except for verse 11. Verse 11 I'll come back to. But did you notice the odd phrase in verse 12? I mean, the song is talking about what God does to the Egyptians at the Red Sea, right? The earth swallowed them. Now, the earth isn't water. Water is not the earth. I mean, it's an odd thing. What it's going to take us into, that comment and some other things in these verses, is Israelite cosmology, specifically the underworld, you know, the underworld deep, as it were. So this is underworld imagery that's used of what happened in or at, you know, this particular body of water that we talked about a few weeks ago. Durham says here, there is a subtle but important shift from waters, the Hebrew term mayim, and currents, neither of which refers to the primordial waters of chaos, to the ancient deeps, which is Tehom. Okay, and Tehom is actually used in this passage along with these other two terms, when it says the deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. It's Tehom. The implication, Durham says, at the very least, is that the visible waters in their everyday flow were thrust aside to make way for the temporary release of the devastating rebellion waters from their subterranean prison, you know, the ultimate deep, the Tehom. Then these same waters, the very symbol of disorder in motion, because the deep, again, is the chaotic mess, if you think back to Genesis 1. This is the chaotic state out of which Yahweh creates order. You know, God creates an ordered place of habitation for humanity. You know, darkness was over the face of the deep. Okay, and again, implying some sort of control. Then you get refashioning in Genesis 1. So Durham is saying, here we have the same concept, this primordial deep, this subterranean waters, the waters that were in the three-tiered cosmology of Israelite thought, waters under the earth. Remember, to an Israelite, the earth was a round, you know, flat thing floating on water. You say, well, where's the water? Isn't the water also on earth? Again, you're thinking like a 21st century person when you ask questions like that. The writers are not 21st century people. Okay, they're not asking questions about where the water came from, where it is in relation to other water. Okay, it's just you have this primeval mound come up out of the earth. It's surrounded by water. It floats on water. And then God, of course, fastens it. He fixes it with pillars, the pillars under the earth. Again, this is all standard Old Testament cosmological language and ancient Near Eastern cosmological language. And the water under the earth, the great deeps that would threaten again to break the pillars and unleash chaos on the habitable landmass. And that's what this term, Tehom, is talking about. So back to Durham, he says, again, these same waters are the very symbol of disorder and motion are, in the Exodus account, made solid. They congeal. They are stilled in the middle of the sea, and God makes them sort of stand up like walls. And when God does that, the earth, verse 12, swallows the Egyptians. So, well, how does that make sense? Well, it makes sense because the great deep now, that is, again, cosmologically under the earth, that's been split apart and congealed and made into walls. And so that opens up this cavernous thing. Basically, the Egyptians slide into the underworld. They go to hell, okay, if you want to use, you know, later language for this sort of thing. This is the idea. They're all sent to the underworld. And Yahweh is the sovereign over the inescapable underworld. And remember, from Unseen Realm again, that one of the terms for land, Eretz, is also used of the underworld. Eretz, same word. And that's what we have here when it says the earth swallowed them, the Eretz swallowed them, the underworld swallowed them. They're dead. Okay, they're dead and they go, there's no escape from this realm because, you know, no Egyptian deity is sovereign over this because it's Yahweh commanding the great deeps to congeal and swallow the Egyptians. So there's, again, some cosmological thinking going on here. Now, there is an interesting article that compares this language. That takes this language and the language of other passages and tries to make an argument. I think there's some really good material in this article where you can connect this kind of language, the language used of the Red Sea and what happens there, with Sheol, with the realm of the dead. And that is not to say that, on my part, that's not to say that this wasn't a historical event. There's just two aspects to it. This is like anything else in Exodus, and frankly, like lots of things in the Hebrew Bible. There's sort of the boots on the ground interpretation of what's going on, what the text says, okay, and that the writer's talking about. But then there's this sort of cosmic, supernaturalistic, metaphysical kind of thing, you know, interpretation behind all that. This is another case in point. what happens at the Red Sea to the Egyptians, again, is viewed as sort of, you know, event kind of terms, you know, historical event terms. And then there are these cosmic terms. There are two ways to read the same material. Now, this article is by a fellow named Wiffall, W-I-F-A-L-L. And let's see if I have an article reference to it. The article is about, I don't know if this is actually a title, how the Sea of Reeds is based on Egyptian symbolism or gets tied into Egyptian symbolism, specifically the Shehor, which is the Egyptian equivalent to the Hebrew Sheol as the place of death. Now, interestingly enough, okay, go back to our discussion again a few episodes ago about where the crossing occurred. Again, you think of the Red Sea, you got the left prong, that's the Gulf of Suez, and then at the tip of that, you've got a bunch of bodies of water that in ancient times were connected, in some cases by canals, you know, forming the eastern border, you know, of Egypt, of the delta there. Basically, again, if you pass through that or cross over that, you're out into an Egyptian, you're out into the wilderness and the chaos and all that kind of stuff. But this is borderland territory. Okay. So we talked a lot about that, this chain of lakes, you know, and it factors into the way the Old Testament describes the crossing at, you know, Pi-Hahiroth, the mouth of the canals, again, at some point along this chain of bodies of water. So we don't know which body of water they crossed, but it was in this sort of, you know, conceptual and literal barrier or border, you know, borderline waterway link, you know, all these bodies of water linked together. So one of those bodies of water is the Shehor, believe it or not. And again, that's a term that is associated by the Egyptians with the underworld. This particular place is near Avaris or Avaris. Again, this is in the Delta. And we have a map on the episode webpage so that you can see where this is. Again, it's one of these bodies of water. So this might be, if Wiffall's article is correct, that the language here, not only of Exodus 15, but, you know, some of the other parts of this event description, if this is tapping into Egyptian belief about this one particular place, maybe that's the place that they crossed. Because the Egyptians going in there to pursue after them wind up in the underworld. Again, maybe that's the case. Now, I'm going to read a little bit from Wiffall's article just so that you get a feel for it a little bit. A couple of portions here. So he's going through the history of scholarship, you know, on this in his article, and he writes this. An article by L.S. Hay on the historicity and history of the tradition of the Reed Sea events points to another source besides Canaan for the mythological elements in Israel's description of her exodus from Egypt. Again, mythological, this is me breaking in here. Mythological is a term that most scholars are going to use for cosmic terminology, you know, something about their, you know, connected to the supernatural worldview. You know, whether this author treats the event as historical or not, you know, is a different question, different but related question. But don't get thrown off by that term. Back to Wiffall. In arguing for a military encounter in which Israel defeated the pursuing chariotry of Pharaoh, Hay proposed that this basic historical account was later overlaid in the tradition by a Sheol myth, possibly derived from Egyptian mythology. Hay cited an article written several years ago by J. Towers concerning Egyptian influences on the Reed Sea story. Towers pointed out the equation between the Hebrew term Yam and the Egyptian Sheh, sea or lake. Probably in Egyptian would be Esh. In Egyptian mythology, the lake or field of reeds was the underworld where the soul of the dead was purified before ascending into heaven. The soul was said to pass over the underworld sea of reeds. Well, isn't that interesting? Let me just break in here. Isn't that interesting? For an Egyptian, again, an Egyptian acquainted with these texts, this lake, I'll read it again, was the place where the soul of the dead was purified before ascending into heaven, kind of like a purgatory. The soul was said to pass over the underworld sea of reeds, much as the historical Passover of Israel and the Reed Sea events. I'll finish Wiffall's sentence there. Guess what, folks? Again, if you're an Egyptian and you're either witnessing the events or if you're a Hebrew familiar with this and you're reading about it later on in Exodus 15, this is not purgatory. The Egyptians ain't going anywhere. They're dead. They are in the realm of the dead for keeps because it's the God of Israel who has command over this. Okay, he sets the terms. Again, this would have really, again, struck fear into an Egyptian. And again, the biblical writer, if indeed, again, Wiffall is correct, that we have these connections back into Egyptian thinking, the writer knows exactly what he's doing. Again, if you're someone who's familiar with this belief, either because you're an Egyptian or about the Egyptians, you're going to know that this is a theological statement. You're not going anywhere, buddy. Okay, you are in the underworld. This isn't just like a temporary thing that you're going to get out of here later. No, you're not getting out of anywhere. You're locked up. Back to Wiffall. Tower's remarks about Egyptian mythology as the possible source of the Exodus imagery can be amplified through studies by Egyptologists such as Frankfurt, Raymond, Zandi. For example, Frankfurt, in his study of Egyptian religion, noted a close relation between the geographical lake and field of reeds and the mythological region of the dead. And Frankfurt, this is me again, Frankfurt is a major figure in Egyptian religion. All sorts of stuff you can get, you know, online or books by him. Back to Wiffall. Raymond, in her study on the mythical origins of the Egyptian temple, has also emphasized the importance of these two geographical regions in Egyptian mythology. On the one hand, the lake, with its field of reeds, was both the site of the first creation and of the earthly temple, where life was renewed daily in the royal cult. Indeed, the temple's design and complex reflected the reeds in the pool or lake of the mythical creation setting. On the other hand, although the sun rose daily with life, it also set on the western horizon into the dark abode of the dead, so that the lake represented also the pit where the nightly struggle between light and darkness was waged. The light was the place where Apophis, the serpent of darkness, was pierced and slain by the sun god in both primeval and daily combat. Just as Ra expelled or repelled Apophis in heaven, so the Egyptian king was believed to drive out disorder daily and establish justice, Ma'at, in the land. In his study on the Egyptian concept of death, Zandi has cited terms and descriptions of the underworld lake of reeds, which recall the Old Testament's concept of Sheol. For example, the Egyptian dead were at times called the drowned ones, and the wicked were said to be burned by fire. Let me just stop there. You know, in Old Testament talk about Sheol, there's both water and fire. Okay, back to Wiffall here. They're said to be burned by fire as Yahweh burned his enemies. In fact, Israel's understanding of the underworld as a great body of water upon which floats the disk of the earth, and her fear of death in the sense of drowning and inundation would appear to reflect more the attitudes of Egypt than those of Ugarit or even Babylon. We'll just wrap up Wiffall there. And I will put Wiffall's article in the protected folder as well for newsletter subscribers. But I mean, there's some good stuff here. You know, if you're looking at this again as an Egyptian or someone who's, you know, familiar with Egyptian thinking, this accounting of the Exodus, the elements of it, the Sea of Reeds, you know, where, you know, it's on the border of Egypt. You go over the other side, it's chaos. And, you know, you don't want to wind up in this water here, this specific body, because, you know, again, that would be, you know, where the dead go. I mean, if you go there, you're going to be dead. But, you know, the good news is you're only going to be there for a while, because it's kind of like Egyptian purgatory, and you'll get out and you'll go to heaven. When and if, and I think there is something, you know, to this, the biblical writers are drawing on these ideas. You go back and you read Exodus 15. No, this is not a temporary situation. They've been judged by the one who has control over the deep, because it was Yahweh who made the waters of the deep congeal and stand up like walls and let his people pass through. They're the ones that go to quote unquote heaven, because they're on their way now to Yahweh's domain. We said last week, you know, about, you know, other elements of Egyptian thinking. Israel's not, you know, they shouldn't have been afraid, you know, to traverse the wilderness on the way to God's house at Sinai. Okay. The place where God lives, and then on to the land of Canaan, where God will put his name and be, you know, they will be his people, he will be their God, all that sort of stuff. Again, this is all Edenic. This is all establishing the domain of Yahweh, the divine abode, you know, the people of God on earth, you know, the God's original intent back in Genesis, that whole thing. Again, if you've read Unseen Realm, this is familiar territory to you. If you haven't, I'm sorry, but you need to go read the book. I can't repeat all the content in every episode, you know, when we get into this kind of stuff. this is familiar territory. These are repetitive ideas and concepts. They mime and mimic and build off each other, step by step through Scripture, all the way to the end of the book of Revelation. Okay, these are repeating themes. And, you know, if you're aware of that, you can look at this material, and it's like, hey, they shouldn't have had any fear going through the wilderness, you know, the place of chaos, because who was in control of that? Well, evidently Yahweh is, because look at what he did with this really big bad place, you know, the Red Sea, you know, because that, you know, to an Egyptian, that, you know, that was the gateway to the realm of the dead, and, you know, all these ideas. It's Yahweh's people who are taken out of the realm of the dead to new life. Okay, at the Exodus event, at the crossing event, not the Egyptians. And that shows the Egyptian, and of course the Israelite who's familiar with these ideas, who's in charge. It's just as simple as that. Who has sovereignty, who has authority over these forces of chaos, life and death, eternal death and eternal life, you know, dwelling with God, you know, forever as opposed to not. I mean, who is in command of all this? Well, it ain't the gods of Egypt. Again, it's just theological messaging all over the place. Let's go back to Exodus 15:11, as we skip that. I'll read it to you again. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Among the Elim there in Hebrew. Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? Now, Durham, again, in his Word Biblical Commentary, the Exodus volume, writes this: Yahweh is extolled as incomparable among the Elim, among the gods, any and all beings for whom divinity is claimed. There is simply none like him, none even approaching an equality with him. He is magnificent in the holiness that sets him apart. And that's essentially what holiness means, to be set apart, to be other. He is magnificent in the holiness that sets him apart from all of others. He references Labushan, that's Labushagne. I'm probably messing up the name. I think it's French. Who wrote an important book, The Incomparability of God, in the Old Testament. It's really hard to find. I use it for my dissertation. It's an important work. If you ever find it, you snatch it up, unless you got to take a loan out, okay? It's just hard to find. But he references this book on pages 79 and 80, and he makes the comment that Labushan would emend in holiness. Okay, who is like you, majestic in holiness? The phrase there, in holiness. Labushan wants to change that to from, you know, Bakodesh to Bakadoshim. So he wants to make it plural. You say, well, why would he do that? You know, why does Labushan think that's a better reading of the original text? Well, he said, because that's what the Septuagint has. The Septuagint has en hagiois. It's a plural. You say, well, who cares? What does it matter? Well, it's just kind of interesting. This is just like a nugget to throw out. It would read then, who is like you, majestic among the holy ones? It would be a nicer parallel to the preceding line. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic among the holy ones? And, you know, ultimately Durham says, I'm not persuaded. I don't think it's necessary. Well, nobody says it's necessary, but it's still reflected in the Septuagint. And I will add, this isn't the only place that such an emendation might be merited on the basis of what looks to be like a different text that the Septuagint translator had. Just again, it's just a nugget to throw out there. It would sound, in other words, Exodus 15:11 would sound a little bit more like Psalm 89:5-7. And even in Psalm 89, which is again a very famous divine counsel passage, even there are others like Dahud, the famous Ugaritic scholar and Psalms scholar, who argue for a couple places in Psalm 89 that there are some things there that should be pluralized as well, just to bring out the council imagery a little bit more as far as the composition of the council, you know, the gods there. So again, you can look that up if you're interested, but it's just kind of an interesting observation. You have textual evidence, apparently, in Septuagint, working with a different text, different Hebrew text, had a plural there. It just brings out the divine council thing a little bit more. And again, the point is theological. Who is like you among any member of the heavenly host? Who's like you among the Elohim, the Elim in council, or the B'nai Elim, Psalm 89? And the answer is nobody. So no, as you know, my one article that I put in the title, you know, you can't say you've seen one Elohim, you've seen them all. No, in Israelite thinking, there is one among them that is unique. Species unique, utterly incomparable. Incomparable in terms of who he is, ontological uniqueness. And so, you know, you even find that in Exodus 15. Now, if you get to, you keep reading in Exodus 15, we'll run into a couple other things here. We've read through verse 12, so let's hit verse 13. You have led in your steadfast love the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them by your strength to your holy abode. Let me read that again. You have led in your steadfast love the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them by your strength to your holy abode. You say, why would I include this in our discussion? Because it sounds like they've already been to Sinai. This again is a clear textual element that suggests that Moses he's either not writing this then, like this wasn't somebody like they get to the other side of the Red Sea and Moses breaks out in song and somebody writes this down, or he says, I'm going to break out in song now, start writing. No, it's after the fact. They've already been to Sinai. Now, you know, other scholars would say, well, yeah, they've already been to Sinai. I mean, this is written way, you know, centuries after, you know, the biblical events. Okay. And that could well be. I like to point things out like this to you to, again, reinforce the point that when scholars wonder about when something gets written, it's not because they're just sitting in a dark room wondering what to do. You know, what can we think up next, you know, to like talk about Bible stuff or get after the fundamentalists or something like that. That's not what they do. They're looking at the text and they're going, sounds like they've already been there. So how could that be Moses? You know, so there are just these things in the text that are very easy to read over. But again, I'm trying to reinforce the point that biblical scholarship, even biblical criticism, you know, criticism, and when you hear, you know, higher criticism, that's about things like, when was it written? How the text as we have it come together? Was it written or transmitted in stages? You know, all this kind of stuff. You know, and we hit this, we have hit it, you know, through the Exodus series here. There are just things like, again, that are easy to overread in the text that are just there that make you ask these questions if you're a close reader. Now, you know, what you do with it, and again, what your presuppositions are when you start thinking about it, it's a related but a different question. But again, just so that you're aware that this stuff does arise from the text. You look at the next couple verses 14 through 16. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. Because of the greatness of your arm, they are still as stone. Till your people, O Lord, pass by, till the people pass by whom you have purchased. You know what that sounds like? That sounds like Rahab at Jericho. Hey, we've heard about what happened at the Red Sea. That just kind of freaks everybody out. We know you're going to kick our butts. So, like, please save me and my family. It sounds like the itinerary that Moses and Joshua take on their trip up through the Transjordan, which is long after the crossing of the Red Sea. Again, the content of these verses do not happen as soon as they hit the other side. But, you know, a lot of you, I'm sure, have heard, well, I can't say a lot of you have heard this preached because it's the Old Testament. A lot of churches don't even preach the Old Testament anymore. But if you have heard this, chances are that the setting that's described for you is, you know, they get through the sea and everybody just kind of stops and Moses breaks into song. And isn't this awesome? Well, yeah, it is awesome. But you have stuff like this in it that is clearly much later. So again, these things arise from the text. It's not people just sort of making stuff up. Currid, in his commentary, his study commentary on Exodus, the first volume, Exodus 1 through 18, writes this. All four nations, these nations that are mentioned in the verses I just read, were to become notorious enemies of Israel. Philistia was located in the coastal plain of Palestine, and the Philistines often fought with Israel during the early centuries of her existence, Judges 13 through 15, 1 Samuel 4 through 7. The Edomites were descended from Esau, and they populated the area of southern Transjordan. They struggled with Israel in order to not let her pass through the territory, much later in Numbers 20. Moab in central Transjordan was the home of the descendants of Lot. Balak was one of the kings of Moab during the conquest period. in Numbers 22. The Canaanites, of course, inhabited the land of promise, and many of them were destroyed by the Hebrew invasion of Palestine. Now, you know, Curd doesn't want people to think, and I don't know why, because so what if this was written after the fact? But, you know, he's like, well, you know, I know that sounds like later authorship, but blah, 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 blah. You know, well, it is later authorship. Because nobody's there, you know, CNN isn't there. They'd probably destroy it anyway if they were. But CNN isn't there with a camera and beaming it into Philistia. You know, this isn't like a real-time, moment-by-moment, blow-by-blow commentary. Of course it's after the fact. It's very obvious. There's no harm in this, you know, saying that parts of the, you know, Moses could have written it later if you want Mosaic authorship. But you don't even need that either. And we've talked about this before. My point is here to again, show you that if you read the text closely, these things just pop out. These questions arise. You keep reading verses 17 and 18. Again, this is interest in terms of a polemic against the Canaanite divine council, El and Baal. You might think, oh, good grief, how do you get that out of verses 17 and 18? Well, let me read it here. You will bring them in and plant them on your mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode. By the way, that sounds like it's contradictory to the earlier verse where it seemed like they'd already been there. Okay? Just you know, pay attention for the sake of the point we are making. We're not going to get into authorship and editorship and all this kind of stuff, but you will bring them in and plant them on your own mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord will reign forever and ever. You say, how in the world does that relate to the Canaanite divine council, all that El and Baal stuff from Ugaritic? It does. Curd, again, takes note of this. This epilogue looks even further into the future when God will establish Israel in the land of promise. The Hebrews will build a sanctuary there to worship Yahweh. The designation of a mountain, this is Curd's talking now, obviously refers to Mount Zion, where the temple will ultimately reside. Okay. I'll read verse 17 again. You will bring them in and plant them on your mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. So I would agree. I mean, this is temple language. It's Zion language, which is much later. It's necessary, Curd says, when he starts talking about chronology, we'll just cut him off there. Where I want to zero in on is he does notice the parallel here on the mountain of your inheritance, the place of your dwelling that occurs in, again, these verses. That's important. The reference to the sanctuary, to the mountain, to the divine abode, these are stock terms used of divine council stuff. And the Hebrew terms here are used, they have Ugaritic equivalents. So Curd, you know, takes note of this and he starts talking about it. And he says there's probably a polemic here against the Canaanite divine council, specifically Baal, because Baal is the one who gets a house after his battle with Yam and Mot, the god of death and the river. You know, Baal is declared king of the gods and he gets a house, and Baal is declared king of the earth. Look at verse 18. The Lord will reign forever and ever. And that language is close to the language used in the Baal cycle of Baal. And so Curd and others look at this and say, there's something going on here in the text where the writer not only wants to tell us what happened to the Egyptians and is dipping into Egyptian worldview stuff, but the writer is also given Baal and El, and the divine council, the Ugaritic stuff, the Ugaritic pantheon, giving them a poke too. Because it's not Baal who is Lord of the earth. It's Yahweh. Now, again, for my part, I do think that there is, you know, something to this. There's no dispute that Canaanite literature existed at the time of the Exodus. So if you want Mosaic authorship, you know, there's no obstacle there. The issue is when the Israelites, or even Moses, when would they have really been exposed to Canaanite religion as an opposing system? That's much later. That's the time of the prophets, the monarchy. Certainly not in Egypt. Okay, they're not exposed to Ugaritic religion in Egypt. You know, the full-blown El and Baal as a competition to Yahweh. That's going to be later. So again, I think what we have here is we have either an editorial hand or something going on, maybe an original part of the original composition or an editorial hand that wants to loop in Ellen Bale, Canaanite thinking, into this story and say, Yahweh's not only better than the gods of Egypt, he's also better than these guys over here. You know, Yahweh is the one who is, again, at command. He takes his people, you know, through the waters of chaos, through the chaos wilderness. He's taking them to Zion, where that is where his abode is. That's the realm of God on earth, the high God, the most high, all this kind of stuff. And he's going to build his sanctuary there. And the Lord, Yahweh, will reign forever and ever. He is king of the whole world, not Baal. And I think that's entirely, you know, entirely possible. And I wanted to sort of riff on this a little bit, because what you have here is, again, this is territory that those who are on this evolutionary trajectory perspective of Israelite religion, they're going to sort of look at this and say, well, yeah, you know, the writer wants to do that because at one time, you know, he has to sort of, you know, establish the fact that Yahweh is now king of all the nations. And that wasn't true at one time. Yahweh was just one of the council of El. Again, if you've read Unseen Realm, if you've read any of my articles, if you've read, you know, some of the other things that I have on the website, this is common, the common perspective of Israelite religion. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 32:8. When the Most High divided up the nations, he divided them up according to the number of the sons of God. But Israel is Yahweh's portion. Jacob is his allotted inheritance. And so those who believe Israelite thinking, specifically the biblical writers, not just the Joe Schmo Israelite, but the biblical writers were once polytheists, that polytheism was orthodoxy, that Yahweh was just one of a number of gods. And here we have the Most High, El Elyon, as a separate deity in Deuteronomy 32. And he gives Yahweh a little piece of the earth, and it happens to be Israel. But the Most High, El Elyon, and Yahweh are different deities because they were polytheists. Later on, Israel is going to evolve into the notion where all these names, all these deities are fused into one, into Yahweh. And when that happens, well, Yahweh is Lord of all the earth, because now there's only one God. And so the critics will say Psalm 82 is about the Israelites evolving to this point of enlightenment where they kill off the other gods in Psalm 82 and only leave one, and that's Yahweh. So Psalm 82 for them is proof of the defeat of polytheism in the mind of the biblical writers. Polytheism is no longer orthodox religion. Polytheism has been defeated. Now we have this wonderful breakthrough to monotheism. The lights have turned on. And so that allows the critics, again, you know, to say, well, from that point on, they don't believe the other gods exist. You have an intolerant, exclusivistic monotheism. And so all talk of Elohim means that the other gods don't exist anymore. Again, I reject all that. And if you want to know why, go up to my website, thedivinecouncil.com, read some conference papers and published articles and whatnot. Because there are littered through that neat little picture a number of problems and inconsistencies. Things like assuming that Elohim, you know, plural Elohim, that they're all sort of, you know, equal. That's an assumption. Assuming that El and Elyon are, you know, that Yahweh is a separate deity in Deuteronomy 32. That's an assumption, because if you go back two verses, like, oh, but take the trek back two verses, you have El and Baal epithets both applied to Yahweh. Okay, it's very clear that the writer is not looking at Yahweh as a separate deity in Deuteronomy 32. 6 and 7. So why would he in 8? And if you go to Deuteronomy 4, 19 and 20, Yahweh isn't given Israel. He takes it. It's his choice. Okay, there's all sorts of problems. I'm not going to rehearse all this stuff. You can go back and read this material. But if you're thinking that way, you look at what's going on in Exodus 15 here, and you don't just see a polemic here. You see an evolution out of polytheism, another evidence of this evolutionary trajectory. And I bring this up because it's kind of sad that there are folks in evangelicalism who are buying into this. And I'm not saying that you can't, you know, get the gospel and, you know, and think this way. I'm just saying that you're thinking that way because you've never examined the problems with the whole idea. You know, you're hearing this and you're just buying into it, and you never get to where it doesn't work and why, and the circularity of the argument. And I want to zero in on one of these just for the rest of the episode. This notion in Exodus 15, okay, I'll read it to you again. Exodus 15, 18, the Lord will reign forever and ever. If the evolutionary trajectory is correct, then this idea that Yahweh is the God of all the nations over the earth, in effect that Yahweh now has become the Most High who divides up the nations, okay? If you think that is a late development after the exile, because they're getting punished for this, and then out of the exile comes this breakthrough, breathtaking, wonderful idea of the gods are all dead now and we have only one. If this is what you're thinking, you're going to have some problems. There are other places in the Hebrew Bible where you have this language of Yahweh being king over all the nations that are clearly pre-exilic. They're pre-exilic. You know, king of the earth was a Baal title. And so what we have here is a polemic against Baal. Okay, Baal, of course, the material is pre-exilic. And you have this idea show up because the biblical writers want to establish this point long before the exile. Again, there are just a number of indications that this is the case. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a little bit from my second BBR article, Bulletin of Biblical Research. This is the one about co-regency in the Divine Council of Ugarit and how in the Hebrew Bible that idea was repurposed. In the Ugaritic Council, you had El and Baal, two deities. Okay. Israelite Council did not tolerate that. You have Yahweh applying or occupying both slots. You have the invisible transcendent Yahweh, and you have the Yahweh that appears as a man. They're both Yahweh from the get-go. Okay, and Baal imagery, again, Baal is the one who is anthropomorphized a lot too. You know, again, I don't want to get too technical here, but I'm just going to read a little bit as to how, again, this idea that Yahweh was over the whole earth is an old one. It's not late. It's not something that results from some breakthrough to monotheism, you know, after the exile, during or after the exile. So I wrote this. For example, terrestrial lordship is transparently stated in several enthronement psalms that date to well before the exilic period. Psalm 29:10 declares, quote, the Lord sat enthroned at the flood. The Lord sits enthroned king forever. Okay, that's Psalm 29:10. Lord there is Yahweh. If you're familiar at all, and scholars should be, with Israelite cosmology, you have the waters over the earth, you know, over the firmament. That's where the Lord sits. And the firmament covers all the nations, folks. Psalm 29 dips into Ugaritic, you know, material. And it has this idea. I don't know that any scholar thinks that Psalm 29 is not pre-exilic. So you don't need an evolution to have this thought. It's already there. Yahweh is God over all the nations. There's no one higher that doles him one out. Okay. In Israelite cosmology, back to my article, the flood upon which Yahweh sat was the watery covering thought to be over the solid dome that enclosed the round, flat earth. This throne obviously did not cover only Israel. As such, it cannot coherently be denied that the author viewed the foreign nations under the dome and the flood as being under the authority of Yahweh. The same kingship perspective is echoed in the Song of Moses in Exodus 15:11. Again, Exodus 15 is considered some of the oldest material in the Torah by the source critics. We encounter the rhetorical challenge, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Followed in verse 18 by the Lord will reign forever and ever. As Frank Moore Cross, who he's deceased now, but he was professor, the department chair at Harvard, Near Eastern Studies, for many years. As Cross noted many years ago, quote, the kingship of the gods is a common theme in early Mesopotamian and Canaanite epics. The common scholarly position that the concept of Yahweh as reigning or king is a relatively late development in Israelite thought seems untenable, unquote. And I would agree. I think Cross puts his finger right on it. This is an old idea. Other pre-exilic texts, this is me now, can be brought to the discussion. Psalm 47:2 not only declares that Yahweh is a great king over all the earth, but in so doing it equates Yahweh with Elyon, the Most High. Quote, "For the Lord Yahweh, the Most High, Elyon, is to be feared. A great king over all the earth." Not two great kings, a great king over all the earth. Verse 7, the same psalm adds, "God is king of all the earth." This psalm belongs to the category labeled by scholars as enthronement psalms. J.J. M. Roberts argued that the psalm should be situated in the, quote, "cultic celebration of Yahweh's imperial accession, based on the relatively recent victories of David's age." David is pre-exilic. A narrative sampling of the same idea is readily available in the Deuteronomistic history, which is also pre-exilic. The writers of the DH, the Deuteronomistic history, presumed that Yahweh controlled the destiny of the nations targeted for removal from Canaan. Israel's pre-exilic biblical writers expressed the belief that Yahweh had defeated and banished the nations in Israel's land, an idea that presumes Yahweh was supreme over the gods of those nations. And as we have seen, this supremacy is cast anthropomorphically by means of the angel in whom was the name who is Yahweh. That's the end of my article portion. Again, I think we need to, you know, without, you know, getting into names and podcasts and all this kind of stuff, this notion of this evolutionary trajectory within Israelite religion is seeping into evangelical thinking. Now, again, this is not something that the gospel succeeds or fails on. And I've also written and said in interviews, look, on the one, you know, let's just pretend that Mike doesn't hold Mike's views. Let's just pretend that the evolutionary trajectory is correct. That is easy for an evangelical to handle. It's called progressive revelation. Is it impossible that God could have told the biblical writers only limited information about himself? And then later on, as they get more information, they sort of figure out, okay, you know, like, you know, there's, you know, God is unique, and, you know, Yahweh is different than the other ones, and there's none like him. You know, before, you know, we were talking about councils. Is it possible that because God gives them more information that they go through this evolutionary arc? Sure, you could look at it that way. I think you actually have a tough time if you actually pay attention to the text, because you do not have that neat picture, and you certainly don't have it after the exile. Remember, Dead Sea Scrolls, you got 180 references to divine plurality. They didn't get the memo there. And those guys at Qumran were not liberals. They were not progressives. Okay, they were about as uptight about theology as you could possibly get. And they're not offended at all by the talk of divine plurality. And I would suggest the reason is because it has always been part of biblical thinking, biblical worldview, supernatural worldview. And they always viewed Yahweh, the biblical writers anyway, they always viewed him as unique among the gods, because they don't view Elohim as a term that is connected to a specific set of unique attributes. That's not what the term means or signifies. The reason that the biblical writers use it of half a dozen different things, different entities, is because all it really means is that you are by nature a resident, a disembodied member, disembodied inhabitant of the spiritual world. That's all it is. And that has nothing to do with polytheism as moderns conceive it. But people, and I'm including scholars here, have literally not thought about the topic. Literally, they haven't done it, because it's repeated so often in biblical studies that people just reflexively conclude there's nothing to think about here. On my Twitter feed today, I saw a New Testament textual critic, New Testament scholar, say this: if you repeat the idea that Gehenna was a garbage dump often enough, even scholars will begin to believe it. Again, his point is that there's no evidence for that. Well, I'll give you the Old Testament equivalent. If you hear often enough about the evolution from polytheism to monotheism in Israelite religion, you hear that often enough, even scholars will believe it. And most of them do. And now, again, we have evangelicals that just don't think really anything about this. And again, it's not like the gospel is in trouble here. It's not, because there's other ways to process this progressive revelation. I get it. I just think the whole thing is incoherent. I think it implodes on itself upon close examination, which is why I don't accept it. And again, this was the subject of my dissertation. It's just something that, for one reason or another, I wound up, you know, seeing, thinking about, and then winding up doing a dissertation on it. So, you know, there are elements. We're going to stop here because I don't want to go past, you know, verse 21 here. We'll just stop right here. Next time, part two, we're going to do verses 22 through 26, because we have a reference there, interestingly enough, and I want to be able to give it the time that it deserves. I'll read you verse 27, the last verse. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the water. Now, if you don't see divine counsel stuff in there, cosmic geography in there, then this is probably the first time you've ever been exposed to those topics. That's just loaded. And again, there isn't much written on that verse or this section of Exodus 15 in which it is found. So I've gotten this question a number of times, and I want to devote an episode to it. So I figured this is a good place to do it. Part two, chapter 15. There's a lot of interesting stuff there that I think, again, this audience especially will get a lot out of. But again, for the sake of wrapping up this episode, again, there are things in this chapter that, if you know kind of what you're looking at, that take you well beyond just, oh, we got version two of the crossing of the Red Sea. Isn't that nice? Well, we do. But again, there's a lot of things here to drill down on that take you into other areas of cosmic geography, divine counsel, worldview, you know, just ways to think about the text. And so this is what I like to try to do when we hit, you know, these things in podcast episodes, just to drill down a little bit and say, hey, there's more to look at here than what you might suppose.
I want everybody out there to raise your hand that have just in the past read Exodus 15 and just glanced over it. Raise your hand right now. My hand is up.
Can you see him?
Guilty. Guilty. I am guilty. You know, it's either you're in rare form. You know, that's what that summer drilling on down. I like it because, you know, there's no way that the typical layperson is going to go that far down. You're going to have to listen to the
next podcast. There's just neat stuff. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many chapters of the Bible where I probably just glanced right over it, you know, just the sheer volume of content. And, you know, it takes a scholar to drill down on some of these points. And otherwise, the lay people, me included, I'm just going to glance right over.
Yeah. And I don't want to do it just as points of curiosity, because, again, you say, well, why should I care about what scholars think? Well, you know, you might have a son or a daughter or grandkids, you know, going to college, taking religion 101, and they're going to get this stuff thrown at them. I guarantee it. If they take a Bible as lit class in high school or college, this is what they're going to get. They're going to get this evolutionary perspective. They're going to get source criticism. And it's going to be presented to them in such a way that everything you thought you knew and believed up to this point is just crap. And that is a totally unnecessary conclusion. So I'm real sensitive to that because, you know, I'm just, maybe I get too much email, you know, like that I used to you know, believe the Bible. I used to be a Christian until, and it's just the dumbest thing in the world that, you know, would literally take, you know, back in the day when this happened to this person, this would have taken 5 minutes of time to clear up. But now they're 20 years past it and they've just, you know, they walked away.
Yeah.
And it just shouldn't be.
And not only that, it's just entertaining, you know, for those of us who aren't conditioned one way or another, it's entertaining. Learning about the Bible is entertaining.
Yeah, there's a lot to think.
There's no reason why learning about the Bible cannot be entertaining. You know, I'm one, I don't have to unlearn anything because I really wasn't conditioned one way or another. So I feel for the people out there that are having to walk back and unlearn some of this stuff. But all right, with that, Mike, I just want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com.
To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.